From the Radio Ranch in beautiful Sugar Land, Texas, where life truly is sweeter, it's the Bombastic Blogcast for Tuesday, February 20th, 2024. I'm the G-Man, Dan Gallo.
Hey, G-Man.
You're yourself. Defender of the peace, keeper of the justice, purveyor of truth, and one heck of a nice guy. Let's get things started with
the Daily Denogram.
Yep, words of wisdom, words of inspiration, brain droppings, or noggin nuggets. You get to make the call. It says here, doing a thing wrong for a long period of time gives it the superficial appearance of being right. I want you to remember this as you watch our government.
The United States government would never have, if the president, our president had not, and as far as I know, that's the way it'll always be. Is that clear?
Now for the so-called educational part of the blogcast.
Twisted history.
Should be good.
Gather around, kids, because a lot of things happen on this day throughout history.
To be sure.
Some cool, some not so cool. Just the same. You need to know your twisted history.
Yes, you do.
You might be quizzed.
See? Well, kids, it was on this day in 1872, the Metropolitan Museum of Art opened in New York City. Commonly believed that since then, at least a dozen New Yorkers have actually visited that museum. And it was on this day in 1971, the United States Emergency Broadcast System was accidentally activated in an erroneous national alert. I remember that. I was on the air when it happened. And instead of alerting the troops and sounding a call to action, everybody looked at the teletype machines and said, "What the heck? This can't be right.
Houston, we have a problem."
If you watch politics somewhat closely, particularly the politics of the left coast, this story probably won't surprise you all that much. But San Francisco's Elections Commission has, for what's believed to be the first time in history, appointed someone who isn't a U.S. citizen, who isn't legally allowed to vote, to serve as an official. Terrific article by Melanie Sun of the Epoch Times. She points out the officer, Kelly Wong, was sworn in on February 14th, Valentine's Day. And this is according to a report from the local news outlet KQED. He said that Ms. Wong, an immigrant rights advocate, is a native of Hong Kong who arrived in the United States in 2019 for graduate studies. She was sworn in by the Board of Supervisors President Aaron Peskin during a ceremony at San Francisco City Hall after winning unanimous support from the board. Wow, unanimous support. You can't get any more support than that. Anyhow, Ms. Wong wrote in a LinkedIn post on February 15th, "This appointment is a milestone for all immigrant and marginalized communities throughout San Francisco. Representation matters. Thousands of immigrants living in the city hold stakes in politics, and there's no better way to have us be represented than to serve in leadership positions. I'm deeply committed to ensuring that everyone, regardless of immigration status, has a seat at the table in shaping the future of our city." Well, the appointment of a non-citizen to city boards, commissions, and advisory bodies was made possible in 2020 when voters passed a proposal by lawmakers to remove the standing requirement that candidates seeking office hold U.S. citizenship. Again, what is going on in the minds of voters? What are they thinking? Just come on in illegally over the border, and I don't believe that Ms. Wong came in illegally, but let's just paint this picture. You come in illegally over the border, and immediately you have the right to serve on an election commission as a non-citizen. Now, I'm not saying that non-citizens shouldn't have some form of representation, but theoretically, under our legal system, under our justice system, under our Constitution, when you come in as an immigrant, you do have representation. Certain rights you don't have, for instance, the right to vote. But they're trying to change that, too. Let's just give the country away, why don't we? Anyhow, at the February 14th ceremony, Mr. Peskin applauded Ms. Wong's activism, saying, I'm very impressed by her commitment to enfranchising people who rarely vote, to educating people about the voting process, and to bring in non-citizens and get them the tools they need as they become citizens. Now, the former resident of Hong Kong, which now belongs to China, and recently saw mass pro-democracy protests over the people's lack of true electoral representation, said she hopes to improve immigrant and non-English voter engagement in her new home city of San Francisco, which has a ranked choice voting system. Now, she also told KQED that one of her priorities would be to use resources to improve translations of voter materials. Innocuous enough. I mean, that's okay. She said, I've seen how language and cultural barriers prevent immigrants with limited English proficiency from fully exercising their right to vote. I'm sure there's more than just an element of truth to that, too. Now, Ms. Wong is going to join six other members of the civilian-led commission, whose job it is to oversee policy and operations for the city's Department of Elections. And as all member roles are unpaid, Ms. Wong said she would also continue her work for the progressive advocacy group Chinese for Affirmative Action. It's an NGO founded in 1969. And they say their mission is to protect the civil and political rights of Chinese Americans and to advance multiracial democracy in the United States. That's according to their website. And she has worked for that group since 2022. Now, Chinese for Affirmative Action in 2016 supported other progressive advocacy efforts to further liberalize voting access, lobbying the government to change the law that would allow non-citizens to vote in school board elections if their children attend a school in the district. And their efforts succeeded. There were challenges in the state's courts, but their efforts succeeded. Now, Ms. Wong thanked the city's immigrant rights commissioner, Sarah Souza, who arrived in the United States as an illegal immigrant child and was the first such person in California appointed to the San Francisco Democratic County Central Committee, for her successful campaign in 2020 to change the law and allow non-citizens to serve on local commissions and advisory boards. Now, Ms. Wong wrote in her post, she said, without Sarah's advocacy and perseverance, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to represent immigrant voices and contribute to shaping the future of our communities. To all immigrants in San Francisco, I hope my appointment to the Elections Commission serves as a beacon of hope, showing that change is possible and your voices matter in policymaking. If I can do it, you can too. And then Vincent Pan, who's the co-executive director of Chinese for Affirmative Action, congratulated her, of course, and he told KQED, he says, I'm hoping there'll be a day where it won't be as newsworthy that you have someone who's an immigrant and a non-citizen involved in helping make the city run better, especially in a city where such a large percentage of the community is immigrants. And I understand that point of view. I understand that fully. But at some point, you have to ask yourself, okay, just what are my advantages now for being an American citizen? The Supreme Court has been busy these days, and they're poised to put a stake in the heart of Special Counsel Jack Smith's case against Donald Trump, according to respected legal experts like Jeffrey Rosen, who's a law professor at George Washington University, and he was on CNN on Saturday, and says that if the Supreme Court finds in favor of Donald Trump, it's going to be a significant victory and make things more difficult for the special counsel. Here's what he had to say.
Challenging prosecutions can be productive, as we saw in the Hunter Biden case, where the key informant was just disqualified for lying. So challenging is what defendants are supposed to do. The Jack Smith timing depends on first what the Supreme Court does. Is it going to rehear immunity or just uphold the D.C. Circuit? But then next month, there's a centrally important case in the Supreme Court where the court's going to decide whether the core of Jack Smith's charges involving obstruction of justice are consistent with the Constitution and the law or not. If they throw those out, that's going to be a stake in the heart of the Jack Smith case. It won't prevent it, but it'll make it much harder to pursue.
He also noted that if the Supreme Court justices side with Fisher, it would also call into question the use of the law against other January 6th defendants, including Trump. Now, the case is called Joseph W. Fisher versus United States, and it pertains to the argued misapplication of 18 U.S. Code subsection 1512. I know that means a lot to you, doesn't it? It's obstruction of an official proceeding. And this is being used in January 6 cases. Now, Fritz Ulrich, who is a lawyer for the defendant, Fisher, told Newsweek magazine, such as it is, that he'll argue for a narrow construction of Section 1512 consistent with its language and Congress' expressed purpose in enacting it. Ulrich said that as far as the effect on the other January 6 cases that have a Section 1512 count, nothing's going to happen at the argument that would affect them. But we may be able to discern how some of the justices view the statutory language at issue. So earlier in February, Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas joined 23 other senators in urging the Supreme Court to overturn the Biden administration's legal tactic of utilizing the law to target January 6 defendants, including Fisher. So, Tom Cotton, in his statement, said the Biden administration's pursuit of its political opponents must be stopped. Their strained interpretation of the law would criminalize vast swaths of everyday political conduct and violate the First Amendment. Congress never granted, and no administration should have the power to, lock up political opponents for 20 years for merely trying to influence Congress. Now, last Monday, week ago, yesterday, the Supreme Court scheduled arguments for April 16th in the case involving Joseph Fisher, who was arrested on January 6th. And the Supreme Court is scheduled to hear on April 16th the challenge to the Department of Justice's interpretation of the obstruction of an official proceeding charge that both Fisher and President Trump are facing. So this is a very important case. We're going to watch it. A few months ago, I was mentioning how people on the south side of Chicago are getting really upset. This is a black community, getting really upset over the encroachment of illegal aliens into their community. And how the city had even, in one case, reactivated a high school. Well, they opened the building. They didn't reactivate the school. But they opened a closed high school to house these illegal aliens who were coming into Chicago, some of them being bussed up there by our governor here in Texas, Greg Abbott. Now, Zerlina Smith Members is a victim's advocate, and she's now running for city council, or the, what do they call that? Do they call it city council in Chicago? Because they're known as aldermen, not city council members. Anyhow, she's running for public office up there. But she was on Fox News Channel the other day with Dana Perino, and had a very, very interesting conversation that gives you an insight as to what's really happening in the black community on the south side of Chicago.
Angry people in Chicago as the migrant crisis is draining city resources, and moderate Democrats there are blaming progressives. They say Americans in need are the ones bearing the cost. Zerlina Smith Members is a victim services activist in Chicago. She's also running for the Cook County Board of Commissioners, so she's willing to step up to try to do something. Let me just show you here that the migrants shipped from Texas via bus or airplane to Chicago in the past year and a half, 35,393, so almost 36,000 people. And you have seen firsthand how it's having an effect?
Of course. They're in my community. I'm an Austin resident. They had them housed at our police station when they decided to relocate them from our police station, which was the 15th district. They decided to start giving out more free housing expenses by bamboozling homeowners or commercial owners to let them move into their properties for a stipend. And once that stipend ran out, they're stuck with illegal immigrants running through our community that are living free. Well, we have a mass housing issue when it comes to Chicagoans.
The other thing I read that you said is that you don't blame Governor Abbott. Why?
No, I don't. I don't blame him because he didn't ask for this problem. I commend him for what he's doing. He's dealt with it for long enough, and I do believe that if sanctuary cities want to be welcoming, they should have a plan in place. The city of Chicago nor New York had a real plan, and they got what they had been asking for years.
And as I recall, there was a city council meeting where there was a proposal to withdraw and end the sanctuary city designation that failed. Do you think that it could possibly come up again?
I doubt it, because you don't have the mayor of the city of Chicago running the fifth floor. You have CTU, our Chicago's teacher union, and their progressive elected individuals sitting in our city council who are really not even from here or live in these communities that these migrants are being housed or shipped to.
You also said that the immigration crisis is going to flip the state of Illinois purple. Do you think there are enough people that you're talking to and in your community that are willing to not vote for Democrats this time around?
Of course. In my community, most of our people didn't even vote to elect this current mayor. And the sad part about it is I'm running for his last seat that he held before becoming mayor, which is the first district Cook County Commissioner seat. And those people didn't even vote for him. The rhetoric is that they want to tell us as Chicagoans that we are being taken care of. One in to four children, the Crane magazine just posted that black children and brown children who are born in the city of Chicago are going to bed hungry. But yet and still, they find money to feed illegals. They want to make it seem as though they're, you know, just undocumented. These people are fleeing their country and coming to our country and taking the resources. If my 14-year-old knows that this is a problem and she wants to move to Texas because they don't want them, then it's a real problem when the children are noticing that the Democrats have failed them and my 14-year-old wants to move to a Republican-led state.
Wow. Governor Abbott will probably welcome you with open arms. I just want to show you this. Call 42 here is $638 million. That's the amount of money that the Illinois state has committed to taking care of migrants, and $138 million has been spent since October of 2022. My last question for you is, do you believe that there is any help coming from the Biden administration to help Chicago in this situation?
Well, if our mayor and CTU continue to bojangle around national issues instead of city issues or state issues, I believe that there is no help coming. But because the DNC is coming here, we're going to make sure that we protest and shut it down. So any more money spent is a true problem with not just the black community, but the brown. And we are asking to defund the migrant that are coming to the city and the state of Illinois. We want to defund them. So whatever they do, that's their problem, but we don't want it anymore.
Perhaps it would be prudent to warn the Democrats that, there are blue states that are going to turn purple if you're not careful. And they're not careful. If anything, the Democrat Party has been very negligent. And they've been negligent by default through their zeal to promote radical leftist policies. The open border makes for a really good foundation. Just to show you how wrong-headed an individual can be, during a recent appearance on CNN, AOC was clearly distraught, upset, and unnerved while describing the very real possibility of a Trump victory. Of course, she is a far leftist. Everybody knows that. And she warned that Trump being democratically elected by the people would ensure the end of democracy.
We need to understand what we are staring down in this country. If Donald Trump is elected president of the United States, we do not know if there will be a verifiable next election that has integrity. He already tried to, we saw on January 6th, he tried to overturn the results of a presidential election by force, by inciting a riot. And I think we need to be very, very realistic about the grave, grave impacts of a Donald Trump election. It is not a joke. It is not a game. We need to protect our democracy, and ideally, it's going to be on progressive values.
Yeah, she was blathering on to Jake Tapper, and elsewhere in the interview, she was asked about her concerns over President Biden's age and mental fitness, and according to January's Harvard Caps Harris poll, 63% of registered voters said they have doubts about Biden's mental fitness and ability to run the country. An additional 69% of respondents said Biden's too old to be president. And then when asked about voter concerns, AOC attempted to spin the question on Trump.
I mean, I think right now, when it comes to the president's age, folks are talking about how he's 81. But we have to look at, first of all, Donald Trump is around the same age of 77 years old. They could have gone to high school together. Really? And she says, and beyond that, Donald Trump has 91 indictments. And what I know, who I'm going to choose, is going to be the most successful presidents in modern American history.
One of the most successful presidents in modern American history? Really? She said that with a straight face. And of course, she always looks like she's witnessing the docking of the Hindenburg. But I don't know. She's a great example of how wrong-headed an individual can be. And there are a lot of people out there like her. There are a lot of people who voted for her. And they're going to go to the polls again in November. I just want you to know that. Again, showcasing the necessity for all of us showing up to vote. In a concerning incident that underscores the challenges faced by journalists who are just looking to shed light on border security issues, we have an investigative reporter who was threatened with arrest by a Border Patrol agent in Lukeville, Arizona. Now, the confrontation occurred as the journalist was documenting illegal crossings at the port of entry, highlighting the rather tense atmosphere surrounding immigration enforcement in that particular area. And a fellow by the name of Jeff Rainforth, he's an experienced reporter known for his work in conflict zones. And he found himself in a precarious situation while filming along the border road next to the Lukeville port of entry. Now, if you want to get the attention of law enforcement, you want to get the attention particularly of Border Patrol, bring a camera along, really. That seems to at least get their attention and spark their concern. And despite spending nearly 6 hours walking and filming without any objections from other agents, who even engaged him in conversation, okay, Rainforth was abruptly told that he could be arrested for trespassing, and he was told this by one confrontational agent. So up to this point, he'd been okay, and all of a sudden this guy comes along and says, you could be arrested. So this is raising some significant concerns about the freedom of the press and the right to document and report on matters of public interest. Now, Rainforth had been granted permission by the National Park Service to be on this particular road on foot. So that challenges the agent's claim that he was trespassing. And this discrepancy points to a rather troubling lack of clarity regarding jurisdiction and the rights of journalists in sensitive areas like the border. I don't think there's a more sensitive area on the globe right now than the border. And further, Rainforth's encounter with the Border Patrol agent isn't an isolated event, but part of a broader narrative of challenges faced by anyone reporting on border security and immigration. Now, in his 7 weeks documenting the situation in Lukeville, and that for a reporter, that's a long time to be on one location. He's been there 7 weeks. And in that 7 weeks, Rainforth observed a range of activities, including large groups of migrants crossing through breaches in the border wall. And his efforts to publicize this were met with resistance, not only from the agent who threatened him, but also from other elements within the border enforcement apparatus. So you have to ask, well, what's going on here? I mean, do we have division within the Border Patrol? We have a section of the Border Patrol that's working for Joe Biden, and then another section that's working against him? I'm not sure I like the way that sounds. And the implications of this kind of stuff are pretty far-reaching. They not only hinder the ability of journalists to conduct their work, but also impact the public's right to be informed about critical issues. And there are no more critical issues than this one. How many hardened terrorists have crossed over into the United States undetected? So this confrontation between Rainforth and the Border Patrol agent serves as a reminder of the obstacles that a good many journalists face in their pursuit of truth. particularly in areas where the stakes are high and interests are pretty deeply entrenched. Rainforth's experience also sheds light on the broader context of corruption and mistrust that, believe me, plagues border enforcement on both sides of the U.S.-Mexico divide. Conversations with locals and observations made during his time in Lukeville suggest that corruption may extend beyond Mexican officials to include those tasked with securing the American side of the border. Not hard to believe, right? Allegations like this, if true, complicate efforts to address illegal crossings and undermine the integrity of border security operations and, in the long run, undermine the integrity and the security of our country. So, as this debate over border security and immigration continues to rage, and it does rage because it's outrageous, the treatment of journalists like Jeff Rainforth should concern anyone and everybody who values transparency, accountability, and the free flow of information. Our right to know. So without the courage and determination of reporters like Jeff Rainforth, willing to face threats and intimidation, you and I are just going to remain in the dark about what's really going on, about reality of life on the border. And the numerous complexities of enforcing immigration laws. Shouldn't be that way, but it is. It is supremely important that journalists' rights to document and report on these critical issues are upheld. I don't care what side of the political fence the journalist is on, right, left, or in somewhere in between. They still have the right to be there. They have the right to report on what's going on. Because only by doing that can they ensure that the pursuit of truth isn't stifled by those who wish to keep it hidden. And believe me, good journalists will still find a way to tell the story. To the Comedy Corner with Brian Kiley.
So I'm from Boston. The other day someone said to me, where are you from? And I said, Boston. And he said, the city? I said, no, the 70s rock band? More than a feeling. But I so miss the way things were before the pandemic, right? When things were normal. I was back in Boston a couple years ago. I visited my childhood home. And I knocked on the door and I said, excuse me, I used to live here. Can I look around? And reluctantly, my parents let me in. What's their problem? I was back in New England about 5 years ago. I went to one of those corn mazes, one of those giant corn mazes. I couldn't find my way out. I'm wandering around for like 2 hours. Finally, I took off all my clothes. Because if you're naked, security will come. Security came, they got lost. They took off all their clothes. We were there for days. So I live in LA now. I like LA, it's a strange place. On Halloween, I frightened all my neighbors. I dressed up as gluten. My neighbor told me that meditating for 40 minutes every morning has changed his life. He's late for work, he lost his job. His wife left him. Huge changes. Last week, my wife put together an earthquake plan. In the event of an earthquake, she and the kids are supposed to stand under the doorway. And I'm supposed to stand under the chandelier. She went out and bought a chandelier. So So my wife and I, we recently celebrated our 29th wedding anniversary. Oh, thanks. Thanks very much. Thank you. And I'm happily married. I know that I'm lucky because 50% of married people say they're unhappily married. This is according to a poll I took earlier today at my house.
That's it. Make it a terrific Tuesday. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on tomorrow's Bombastic Blogcast. Remember, no such thing as spare change, free lunch, or too much horsepower. And you be sure to take some time today just to thank the good Lord that you're an American.
That's it?
Tomorrow, G-Man.